Welcome to another edition of Strategic Planning for Business Owners. My name is Steve Young. I am a Senior Vice President at UBS Financial Services. I work on a team known as the Business Transition Consulting Group, where we work with owners of closely held middle market companies throughout the United States going through the process of exiting their company, most of the time through a sale to an outside buyer or even to their employees through an ESOP program. Today, we're going to be talking about some of the non-financial considerations that go into an M&A transaction that can either enhance or detract from the successful outcome of that transaction. And when I talk about successful outcomes, I'm actually talking about getting the deal to the closing table where both the buyer and the seller walk away satisfied that the transaction was in alliance of their expectations and actually both parties feel like they've got a good deal as a result. Today, my guest is David Barrett. David is an executive partner at the law firm of Fager & Drinker. At my last count, Fager & Drinker had over 1,200 experienced attorneys, consultants, and professionals in 21 locations throughout the world, including the United States, London, and Shanghai. Dave, thanks for joining us today, and welcome to the podcast.
Appreciate you having me, Steve.
Before we get started, I always like to give my guests a minute or two to share a little bit about their background and their practice. So if you don't mind, take a minute and share us a little bit about your background and your practice focus.
Sure. Happy to do that. So as you said, Steve, I'm a partner at Fager & Drinker. Been here my whole career, about 27 years now. My practice focuses mainly on M&A, but also the other areas that I would focus on as well are succession planning, and then a number of general corporate matters, corporate governance, review and comment on a lot of contracts, and candidly spend a lot of time with clients on the phone, especially a number of clients who don't have their own in-house counsel. I serve as an outside general counsel resource for a number of clients.
Thanks for sharing that, David. Let's jump onto the topic right now. We're going to be talking, as I said earlier, about some of the non-financial considerations that go into an M&A transaction. And it really going to be talking about two sides of the same coin, either detractors from seeing a successful outcome or things that enhance the opportunity of closing that deal successfully. In your years of experience working with owners going through an M&A transaction, what are some of the things that kind of jump out in your mind as you think about areas where the deals get hung up in the process or maybe even fall apart?
Yeah, good question. So one of the things I like to say, Steve, is I think one thing that kills many deals or makes deals more difficult is surprise. You know, what I mean by that is most deals have some sort of issues related to them that just make it more difficult to close, make it more difficult for a buyer to get their arms around, or just something a buyer, you know, candidly needs to evaluate and make sure it's a risk it's able to take on, that it can monetize, you know, whatever it is. And so when I see deals where sellers are not upfront about those issues, again, those are the sort of deals that I find are hardest to get done. So my advice to sellers is always put those sort of issues on the table upfront. There's often good reasons why those issues are there. And, you know, as we all know, businesses have, they certainly have issues from time to time, right? It's difficult to run a business where you're never going to have an issue, whether it's with an employee or, you know, an environmental issue, a financial issue, or whatever. So I, you know, again, I surprise kills those deals, and I just think it always makes sense to get those issues on the table up front. And then one other thing I would say from a buyer's perspective, to give buyers some advice, I think sometimes buyers are not clear from the beginning about their expectations as well. And in this space, you know, in the closely held business, one of the things I often see is lack of clarity for the owner. Do you want him or her to stay on and run the business, for example? Do you want them to go away at closing? Do you want them to consult, you know, with you? And of course, sellers have their own views on that as well. And so a lot of times those parties are not on the same page on those issues also.
That makes a lot of sense. I would imagine that a lot of times these surprises are not intentionally hidden. And maybe they are, I don't know. But I would think that, you know, most of the sellers, this is probably the first time or the only time they're ever going to go through a transaction like this. And maybe they're just not thinking ahead as to some of the areas that they're aware of running their company that an outside buyer may not be as clued into. But I would imagine that most buyers would expect to turn over some rocks and find things that maybe you know, not necessarily that would scare them off, but things of consideration or concern that they need to be addressing as they go through this process. Would you agree with that? Or
yep, completely agree with that, Steve. I think you nailed it, candidly. I mean, I said before, there's almost always issues in some sort of deals. Sophisticated buyers are, they're aware of that, that they know that's how deals work. And so, again, I think get those issues out there up front. And in my experience, you know, most typically you're able to work through those things.
So a lot of times my team gets brought in kind of late in the transaction. Most of the time there's at least a letter of intent on the table. And sometimes there's even a signed purchase agreement by the time we get introduced to the client. I'm just curious from your perspective, you know, as far as the letter of intent goes, are there some do's and don'ts or some things that should be included that maybe are overlooked or maybe too aggressively laid out in the front end of the transaction that maybe if addressed sooner might make the deal a little easier to get through the closing process?
Yeah, I think another really important question, Steve. And so letters of intent are kind of a push-pull situation in my view. And what I mean by that is that a buyer is typically motivated to have less in the letter of intent. I mean, what they're often looking to do is get exclusivity with a seller and then kind of work through other issues. And so obviously you've got to give a price to someone to get them to sign up with you, but buyers are often most interested in having, you know, as little as possible in a letter of intent and working through some of those issues later. Not always, of course, but I mean, that's probably the most typical in my experience. Sellers, on the other hand, I think are often motivated to have as much as possible in the letter of intent, have as many things nailed down as possible. And I always tell sellers, I mean, that the absolute most leverage you will ever have as a seller is the moment right before you sign the letter of intent. Once you sign the letter of intent, you're typically agreeing to an exclusivity period, and the leverage significantly shifts to the buyer. And oftentimes you've got larger, you know, a buyer that's larger than a seller. So transactions costs on a seller side are often, you know, more of a big deal. But I always look at things like indemnification, which is probably the hardest and most hard-fought issue in transactions. I try to get those things, especially representing sellers, on the table up front, given that leverage point. And there's a lot of other issues as well. Again, going back to that consulting and that employment issue, other things like that. Again, other things that happen post-closing, whether there's a earnout, you know, how does the working capital adjustment work? You know, all those sort of things. And again, it's harder to do that at the letter of intent stage sometimes because you don't have complete information. But I think you'll typically find, and again, more typically a seller than a buyer, you get those things nailed down up front. It makes the negotiation, once you get to a purchase agreement on the back end, much easier.
I'm trying to think back of some of the transactions we've been involved with where I've seen sticking points from the letter of intent forward. And I tend to come back to a couple areas where some due diligence needs to be focused in on, and that would be more along the lines of some of the, I would say, the kind of the side issues such as employment contracts with management people, key employees, leasehold issues, and maybe even environmental and real estate transaction or issues as well in the transaction. Do you see those as major sticking points in some cases?
Yeah, certainly do. Certainly do, Steve. And, you know, again, I think it goes back to this point that every deal has one or more kind of material issues. And again, if you can get those on the table up front, great. You know, and some of those issues and environmental issues are a decent example. I mean, sometimes those take a decent amount of an investigation. You know, you may have to do a phase one and kind of see where that comes out and work through it further. But I think most issues you're often able to get your arms around sooner rather than later. And to your point, again, I think if you can at least have an outline of what you are planning to do in the letter of intent, again, that'll create a good framework and make your purchase agreement discussions easier.
What about with respect to key management people and major players inside the company that's getting sold? How would a seller protect himself in that process from an employee standpoint? Are there some thoughts around that subject?
Do you mean, Steve, like their own kind of employment or their employees and what happens to them post-closing?
Let me clarify a little bit more on my question. So a lot of times I'm talking to owners of businesses and they're really concerned about sharing their intent to sell the company with some of their key employees. They're afraid that, A, they'll get nervous and look for jobs somewhere else, but they're really integral in the negotiation to make sure they stay on with the new owners, or, you know, even concerns about people trying to jockey for position and maybe try to get a little bit more out of the deal as an employee versus an owner, those types of things.
Yeah. No, I understand. So that is difficult. I mean, I think as a seller, you almost always have to have some of your financial people under the tent, so to speak, because, you know, otherwise you're left kind of pulling all the information yourself. You know, you can get help oftentimes with outside accountants and other financial consultants, but there's only so much that they can do. I mean, it doesn't take long in a transaction where you're getting into some pretty significant detail in the financial aspect and others as well. And so I think you often are going to want to try to put a few people under the tent. You know, I often see closely held sellers sign deal-specific confidentiality agreements with some of their key employees to bring them under the tent. Because again, you certainly don't want the word to spread out to the whole company. You sometimes see retention bonuses as well as a way to really incentivize people to do the hard work that a transaction takes. And it really is a lot of hard work. It's kind of a full-time job for many people for a few months. So you'll see retention bonuses again kind of put on the table. But I think you hit an interesting issue there. I mean, there are a lot of people, especially if they've been through transactions in other contexts. I mean, at some point, they kind of think to themselves, wow, you know, I'm going to have a new owner at some point, potentially a new boss. And is my loyalty going to kind of shift from seller to buyer? And I think it's, you know, it's just something as a seller you got to really keep your eyes on.
As an owner is considering going to market with their business, are there certain processes that they should go through from a legal standpoint to review certain areas of their business? Or is there a pre-transaction legal analysis that you would recommend that they follow before they get to the point of going to market?
I think there is for sure, Steve. I mean, it's hard to say one particular way you would do it every time, because it does depend a lot on the type of business you have, how big the business is, and kind of what some of the issues are within the business. But there are some basic things that are common to all businesses. I mean, you're definitely going to want to have your governing documents, you know, kind of in order. One thing I've also seen with a number of small businesses that create issues are things like S elections. You know, do you have evidence of your S election? Have you had a number of shareholders over the years, and have you potentially done something that might have blown an S election? Because of course, that's big for many buyers and things like that. And I think also just generally as a seller, you know, one big piece of advice I would give sellers is, you know, be organized and be ready for the transaction. Again, a lot of times you'll get offers out of the blue, and that's a little bit different. But, you know, if you think you may be going into a transaction, or certainly if you get approached by someone, take your time a little bit. I mean, you don't have to produce information for someone 2 days after you get, you know, the first approach. But think about what your contracts look like, because you're going to have to disclose those, your permits if you have them, employee issues, employment contracts, you know, those sort of things. I mean, really, the more organized you can be upfront and provide information to a buyer in a pretty methodical and organized manner, the more likely your transactions to go smoothly.
Being that I am in the wealth management business, I do need to ask, from your perspective, going through a pre-transaction preparation with a client, how important do you think that wealth component is for an owner to consider before they go to market?
Yeah, I think, Steve, it's very important. And I'm genuinely not saying that just because I'm talking to you on this podcast. I literally just the other day had this conversation, was talking to a client that is still at this point kind of in the pre-revenue stage, but has really high potential. And, you know, one of the things I said, and they've been at it for a few years, put in a fair amount of money. And, you know, one thing I said to them is, hey, you really need to be thinking about your tax planning and other planning. And I'd be talking to my estate planner and my financial advisors about that, because as you know, and I'm sure could go on and on about here, you know, the more time you have to analyze those sort of things, the more opportunity you often have to put different techniques in place and that are typically going to save a fair amount of tax. I mean, sometimes it's also about structuring the transaction, but the big thing is tax. Beyond my expertise, of course, but, you know, I consult financial advisors all the time about these sort of things, estate planning partners in my firm. You know, I see people put GRATs and other sort of trusts. And, you know, there's, as you know, there's a lot of different techniques. But as you said earlier in this podcast, you know, if you're not involved until the letter of intent, or I know sometimes you don't get involved until the proceeds at the bank, right? I mean, the less time you have to prepare, the more typically your choices are more limited at that point.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments. And we do, you know, I've talked a lot about this in the past, but a lot of times we do get involved late in the stage of the process, and it limits the amount of planning that we can do to help consult the client for various reasons, for taxes, estate planning issues, and things of such. But we find that most of the sellers going through the transition tend to push the personal wealth management side, the equation, to the side. We'll kind of get to that point after the money clears their bank and hits my bank account. And sometimes that's a little bit too late to take advantage of some of the better opportunities that might be out there for planning purposes. But a lot of times we talk to clients about replacing their liquidity from, they're going to be transitioning the ownership of an asset that they know how to make money with to somebody else. And they're going to have to find a way to create liquidity in the process that allows them to maintain their daily lifestyle, et cetera. And then also making sure that money is appropriated for long-term purposes and they don't run out before they expire. So a lot of planning should go in from the personal standpoint as well during that transaction period. There's probably a couple of other steps that we should talk about as well. But the one comment I wanted to come back to that I really found kind of sums everything up, and we kind of started talking about this at the beginning of the show, is just the whole concept of avoiding surprises, right? So I think that's probably the biggest issue that from both sides of the table, whether you're a buyer or a seller, you want to make sure that you try to disclose as much as possible up front so there aren't surprises. I would imagine the more surprises that are discovered throughout the process, the lower the confidence level will go through time. So are there any other considerations that you want to suggest we talk about before we wrap up today, David?
Yeah, I think, you know, maybe Steve, I hit on this just a little bit earlier, but, you know, another thing I advise every seller I work with of the following, which is, you know, be prepared for the hard work. And I think these sort of transactions are particularly difficult on sellers and even more so on, you know, closely held businesses, because many buyers have, not all, again, certainly, but, you know, many buyers, especially financial buyers, strategic buyers that have M&A departments and all that, they have a lot of resources and they have a lot of experience, you know, doing these transactions. And as you mentioned earlier, a number of sellers, they've never done it before and it's difficult. And so you got to really be prepared. I tell people you have, as a seller in particular, really two jobs for the 2 to 5 or 6 months these transactions often take. You know, you've got to provide a bunch of information, talk to a bunch of people at a buyer, answer a lot of their questions, so on and so forth in the process, you know, help your advisors negotiate a number of agreements. But you also have to keep running your business. And that's hard. It's a lot of hard work. And it's obviously important to continue to run the business, because until, you know, you close the deal, you're not done. And things unfortunately do fall apart at some point, even at the 11th hour. And so you want to make sure, you know, you kind of keep your eye on the ball from a business perspective. So again, that would be, you know, as I would wrap. And maybe one other point. I mean, I know when I was in law school, and, you know, I don't have lawyers in my family and all that, and I used to think, wow, this is kind of a contentious thing. You know, we all see the TV shows and all that about transactions and other things. And I think one of the keys also in a transaction in general is create a good relationship with the adverse party, you know, whether it's at the lawyer level, at the business level, or whatever. I mean, I think having a good working relationship with open communication, to be clear about timing and deadlines and all that sort of stuff, is really helpful and really, you know, leads to what you all typically want at the end of the day, which is to get a transaction completed successfully and candidly as efficiently as possible, because it's not an inexpensive process. And I think there are definitely things you can bring to the table, you know, both, again, as a buyer, as a seller, and as an advisor, that will help things go more efficiently.
I appreciate that. I really want to hone in on that last comment you made about the relationship between the buyer and the seller, because I would say that the majority of the time when we've seen a transaction move through the process, fairly smoothly, but with the least amount of hiccups as possible, is where there is open and honest communication from both the buyer side and the seller side. And there is generally an interest in making sure that both parties walk away from the table feeling satisfied that they got a good deal in a transaction. And I would imagine you probably have experienced the same thing when there's that type of communication and cooperation in the process. Things tend to go a lot smoother and people walk away from the closing table feeling that they got a good deal.
Totally agree with that, Steve. And the only other thing I would add to that is I advise people also to keep an open mind. I mean, as I said before, I think it's really important to put the most important issues to you on the table up front. And there are some of those issues where you just have a bottom line and you are not going to move past that. And again, that's really important to know. But, you know, especially in a larger, more complicated transaction, there just are a lot of issues out there that you're going to deal with. And work with your advisors on this because they've typically seen these a lot, but try to have some flexibility. There are some issues that obviously matter a lot more than others. And when people go into these transactions and they have very little flexibility, it makes it awfully hard to get done. And like I said before, it also makes things take a lot longer, which often causes it to be more expensive. So, you know, show some flexibility. Obviously be clear about the issues you really, really care about, but there are others that are probably a lot less important. And again, try to show some flexibility and it'll often lead to a more efficient process.
Good stuff, David. Thank you. As I said earlier, we could probably talk about this topic for hours at a time. So thank you so much for your time today. I think we're going to wrap it up here. And I'll just put out there to all the people listening to this podcast today, if you heard something in this conversation that you'd like some more information on, or if you'd like to be in contact either with myself or with David, please feel free to reach out to me either by email at stephen.young@ubs.com or by phone at 317-816-1830, and we'll get your questions answered. Dave, thanks again for joining us today and appreciate your willingness to be on the podcast.
Enjoyed it, Steve. Really appreciate it.
All right. I wish everybody a good day and we'll talk soon. Bye-bye.